submitted for your approval. Okay, that's Rod Serling's probably thrice-used line, but today's topic contains a bit of a puzzler to the curious and intelligent. Why would a food so rich in beneficial bacteria and protein and fat be made illegal or hard to obtain? Well, if you are the general government, just because seems answer enough. Today's episode is about raw milk. There is no shortage of passion for or against, but let's see if we can get to the heart of why it's good. The Culinary Libertarian Podcast, episode 153.
Welcome to the Culinary Libertarian Podcast, where the philosophy is free, but the food is on you.
Hello, folks. Dan Reed here, the Culinary Libertarian. Welcome back to the podcast. Happy to have you here. Happy to be here. Are you that person who sees the fall bounty and thinks of dinner, but struggles with how to make the most of it? Pick up a copy of my cookbook, Cooking for Comfort, for some good ideas. List of ingredients is easy. A procedure that makes you the star is what makes the difference. Find Cooking for Comfort, one-pot meals you can make on Amazon or on my page, culinarylibertarian.com/cookingforcomfort, and cook dinners that make you shine. My guest today is Mark McAfee. Mark is the founder of Organic Pastures Dairy near Fresno, California. It is the largest raw milk dairy and brand in the world, with raw products in more than 2,000 stores nationally and 500 stores in California. Mark also founded the Raw Milk Institute and is an avid medical educator. During the 1980s and 90s, Mark served as a paramedic and is pre-med trained, with time spent teaching pre-hospital intensive care at the local health department. Mark is a mission pilot with Flying Doctors since 1990, serving remote clinics in Mexico, and Mark also flies around the world to share his knowledge of raw milk. Hello, Mark. Thank you for joining me today on the Culinary Libertarian Podcast.
I am so glad to be with you.
Well, I'm glad, and I like your shirt. We're going to talk about it. So you who can't see it, his shirt reads Good Medicine, and we're going to get into that part. So what am I talking about? Look at that. Picture of raw milk. Lovely. So that, yes, we're talking about raw milk. Mark, I invited you on today to talk about raw milk. And you and I chatted a little bit the other day. There are more than a few rabbit holes to explore, and we can't do all of them in one episode. But before we get into any of those, would you just give us a short bio of you and how you got into raw milk?
I was born and raised on a dairy farm. My dad was a dairyman for a while when I was a child. Out of high school, I became a commercial welder for a short period of time. Left the farm. We sold our dairy. And I saw somebody get hurt really badly, and paramedics came in to rescue him. And I thought, that's really cool. I want to be a paramedic on a helicopter just like that. So I spent 17 years as a paramedic doing everything you can imagine in paramedic medicine, including teaching paramedics, recruiting paramedics. I was a pilot for a short period of time. Did everything on a rescue team. I was HR, did everything you can imagine in paramedic medicine, including operational control and management administration with the EMS provider here in Fresno County. In 1996, I retired cold turkey from paramedic medicine, had an opportunity to take over family farms, but I was not going to do it like all my neighbors. I wanted to be consumer connected. I did not want to be processor connected. I wanted to be consumer direct connected. And so I did a lot of research down in Los Angeles at farmers markets and asked people what they wanted to do. And as far as food is concerned. And the mom said, I want to know you. I want to visit you. I want to be able to trust you. I want to see your operations. I don't want GMO. I want organic practices. I want it raw and I want it safe. And my idea was, I'll grow the feed here, but I also want to have the cows eat the feed and make a finished product and then have that finished product be in my own brand in our own trucks going to the stores or farmers markets to feed people directly. So I have a direct consumer connection. And that was all founded in 1998. There's a few other things that happened in my life. I won some awards for creating food safety practices and programs with Odwalla, the Apple company that, you know, I won some awards there. First ever farmer in the United States to prepare a and actually utilize a food safety program on the farm instead of at the processing plant. So I had a little background there to help me out. But nonetheless, that's grown now to Raw Farm and Organic Pastures Dairy, which is the single largest, the largest raw milk producer in the world, serving more people than any other raw milk producer. So wonderful, wonderful basis for my whole business commitment was the connection to consumers. And I had that paramedic background where I was constantly touching people, literally, that called 911 that needed to have to be rescued. And so the background in physiology and understanding how people's bodies worked and their human need, humanity and compassion, coupled with whole food nutrition, which is the ultimate fantastic food to prevent disease, has really been a good coupling. And my wife's a nurse. My son's got his MBA, runs the show now. And I do chief excitement officer stuff, CEO, fun stuff and educational outreach. So that's why I'm here with you today, is to share with people why raw milk is such a great food. It's the first food of life for mammals. And it's it fills a very, very important void where the baby is immune depressed and weak. The most weakened point of life is right at delivery. Breast milk, raw milk, serves that fantastic purpose of being the first food of life to build the immune system and nourish the baby when nothing else can. So that's kind of where we are today.
And with the headlines being what they are, the immune system is much in the news, but now you have to get it from the jab. So you can't have a natural immune system, but that's that's one of those rabbit holes we're going to try to avoid today. All right, so some of the things I want to get into as we get into this conversation is the USDA and the overlords. Why was government involvement, air quotes, necessary? Food as sustenance and food as medicine. But also, let's start in kind of maybe an unusual place. Sure. We're going to talk about milk. So most people's experience with milk is you go to the store and there's dozens and dozens of shelf feet of all kinds of milk choices. And, well, we're out of milk, so let's just go to the back and get more milk. Well, okay, hang on a minute. We're missing part of the equation here. And the real beginning of milk is in the pasture. So I watched a video, one of your videos, and you made a very clear point, and I want you to explain this part. And the woman you talked to in Los Angeles, that she wants safe, organic milk. So when we see, generally we're driving on the road and they're, oh, look, there's cows in the pasture. Sometimes those pastures, they don't look so hot. So what's the difference in the pasture and how the farmers are managing the herds in raw milk operations versus we're making this milk to go and get boiled anyway, so it doesn't matter. Is there a difference in those farms?
Dan, you've opened a wormhole for a thesis here. There's a lot of meat on that bone you just shared with me. I'll tell you that right now. Most pasture-based cows now are beef animals up in the mountains. It's very, very rare to see a cow that's producing milk on a pasture because pastures don't give a lot of high energy for a cow. A cow that's on a pasture is going to give a lot less milk. And today's commercial environment, you have to produce a tremendous amount of milk to sell it to the processor and get a little bit of money back. So it's really a kind of a dead-end street for the conventional guys that are selling the milk to be pasteurized. And the milk you're talking about in the stores, that's all pasteurized milk. In fact, it's interesting how there's been pasteurized milk, and then there's all the milk alternatives, soy milk, almond milk, everything but milk in there, cashew milk, my God, you can make the stuff up. Because it's interesting that pasteurized milk is in decline at about 1% to 2% per year, depending on what you look at, because of the fact that it's the most allergenic food in America. At the FDA website, it's number one, above peanuts. And it's very hard to digest. It's great for shelf life, but not for gut life. So pasteurized milk is really having a hard time right now. Very low milk prices for the farmers who are overproducing because they don't hear the consumers saying, I have a hard time digesting this with lactose intolerance. And it's so allergenic, it triggers my asthma. They're not hearing that because the processors have the microphone. The farmers don't even know consumers. They're just producing tremendous amount of milk on these big CAFO operations, these confinement animal feeding operations where the feed cows are feeding a lot of grain and brewers, distillers, grains, and all kinds of weird stuff to produce lots and lots of milk. Not necessarily sun-drenched vitamin D milk from a cow on a pasture like traditional milk is produced. The USDA actually doesn't regulate milk. They regulate beef and other things in food, but the FDA, the Federal Drug Administration, Food and Drug Administration, they actually regulate milk and eggs. And they don't regard raw milk as a legitimate product. They actually completely suppress raw milk. They don't allow it to be transported across state lines by a processor or by a producer. You can't take it across state lines and sell it. If you're a soccer mom and you buy raw milk, let's say here, and you take it home to Arizona, you can do that. They'll allow you to do that and you won't go to jail. But if I was to do that, they'd show up with a bunch of people here on our farm and say, you're busted, buddy. Come with us, because it's illegal to ship raw milk across state lines because they have no standards for raw milk intended for human consumption. The only standards they have are under the pasteurized milk ordinance, which allows for pasteurization. And let me tell you, those standards are horrible. They allow anything in there. Do you know how many times they test for pathogens in that process? Zero, because they rely wholly, 100% on the heat of the five log kill in pasteurization. They rely wholly on that. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
What does that mean, a five log?
100,000 levels less than what it started. In other words, if you've got pathogens in your milk, they want to have a kill that's 100,000 times reduction of that pathogen. It's a five log kill, five logarithm numbers.
It sounds like what is being produced is functionally a dead white product.
Thermal annihilation of everything in the milk. So you're enzymatically completely destroyed. So enzymes are gone. All of the bacteria are lysed and blown up. The good, bad, and the ugly are all done. And the proteins are denatured. And the bioavailability of the food is really decreased. So it becomes a very inert product with just some fat, maybe a few minerals. Vitamins are pretty much demolished. Proteins are just kind of like there, the building blocks, the amino acids are destroyed. So it's really not a whole food at all. And it's very unfortunate because whole food comes out of a mammal in whole unprocessed form. That's what raw milk is. Enzymes completely active, bioavailability of all the nutrients, including minerals. The vitamins are all active, including all kinds of good, bad, and vitamin K and vitamin D and C and all kinds of stuff there. And you know, it's interesting. The fats are really good too. They aren't oxidized. The bacteria are alive and they're good bacteria. These are yogurt-like bacteria. They're so important for our gut biome and the immune system to function. Remember, 80 to 90% of our immune system is functioning based on bacteria in this wonderful competitive environment, which keep the bad stuff out and keep the good stuff raging in terms of being in charge. So those that know about raw milk are all about it and they become fanatical followers.
You mentioned protein denaturation. And I didn't really think about that, but it stands to reason that, I mean, as a cook, I know that when I'm cooking or baking anything, I'm depending on denaturation. I'm probably saying that the wrong way, but I want that to happen in my steak. I want to denature the protein because I want a nice medium rare to medium steak. Yes, I said medium.
Yeah, break it down. That's important. Yep.
Same thing when I'm baking my muffins. I want to denature the proteins to create something else.
Correct.
But I didn't really think about the protein in milk being denatured into another form. So, and this might be, and you might know, this sounds like a really highly technical question. From the protein that existed in the raw state to what it is transformed into, I'm trying to figure out how to phrase the question.
Sure, how do you
how does the body use that? Or the question I assume seems to assume is that denatured protein useful to the human, or is now just extraneous stuff?
No, the amino acids are building blocks of life. You take that and you make pieces of your body grow. You actually build muscles and do things like that. I spent the last 10 years attending the International Milk Genomics Consortium conferences at UC Davis and all around the world. I've been to Aarhus, Denmark, down in Sydney, Australia, and I'm the only dairyman that goes to these. These places are crowded with PhDs. Yeah, why am I going? Because I want to know what's going on genomically with our food, because I want to explain it to people like you, Dan. The people want to know what's going on with the food. Well, I better do some research to figure that one out. And now, it's interesting that these genomics experts, these milk genomics experts, are actually hired by big industry to tear milk apart to figure out the good stuff, to put it in a pill. They're not looking at whole food. Although, this is really brilliant. They love breast milk. They think it's the greatest thing that ever walked on earth for babies and children and stuff. And they encourage moms to breastfeed, breastfeed, breastfeed. That's raw milk. That's raw milk. So it's interesting that they love raw milk when it comes out of a breast. But when it comes to secondary forms from goats, sheep, horses, cows, reindeer, water buffalo, where people have had it for tens of thousands of years. No, we won't talk about that because it's politically incorrect to talk about raw milk after breast milk, because industry doesn't want competition with processors. They hate that. The grants that go to the university researchers come from these processors that want some value-added pill that they can create to give to people that are deficient in some miraculous thing found in raw milk. Now, in Europe, they're a little different. They feel there's a social consciousness that they need to support people for the betterment of all. Here in the United States, it's all about making the buck. So it's kind of an interesting dynamic that the research in Europe is quite different. And they've got tremendous amounts of research. They're all PubMed peer-reviewed. FDA's got an NIH talking about the benefits of raw milk, decreasing asthma, ease of digestion, fewer ear infections, fewer viral infections, the raw whey protein being so active but destroyed during processing. Right. The raw whey protein actually stabilizes mast cells, which are the origins of histamines. All these kinds of things. The whey protein is a fantastic functional protein, by the way, that we're talking about here. The whey protein destroyed by heat. So that's just one example of many different proteins found in milk, which are absolutely functional and very important in their raw whole form in their active state. But when they're denatured, they actually become very allergenic and don't have the same usefulness as when they are raw form. If you think about raw milk, kind of like blood, you'd never ever think in a million years to have your blood pasteurized before you get an infusion. If you had to have, platelets or something, you're a trauma victim or whatever, you'd never have it pasteurized. It'd kill you. So raw milk, you could think of it more like blood, white blood. In fact, back in the 1800s, when the first scientists were looking at blood and milk, they're very common in terms of how they look. The globules look like hemoglobin, and there's all these serum components, all these things, because it literally comes from the human body. Comes from lacteal glands, which are interesting. And colostrum is actually a blood component. So it's really, really interesting to see how the first fruit of life is really at its highest value in raw form. Now, you can culture it, make it into yogurt. That's great. You can actually cook it, make it all kinds of things. But it's not the immune system building food that it was as it comes from nature. And that's really what's been lost on the whole pasteurized milk community because of the big machine in the last 100 years. To pasteurize everything so you don't have to worry about the safety of it or the conditions in which it's produced. That's why you see so few people actually doing raw milk. It's a specialized niche product because it takes so many special things, like putting a cow out on pasture legitimately. So they get the sunshine and they get the wonderful chlorophyll and things from the pasture. They get the CLA values, the vitamin K, comes from eating pasture, vegetation on the ground. Right. It's interesting how when you don't listen to consumers and moms thinking about their kids, and you listen to processors, you completely change what you produce. And you don't care about what you feed your cows. You can feed them donuts, literally donuts. In fact, I was on a podcast a couple months ago that there was an article came out, said that there was a bunch of M&Ms that were being fed to cows because they had some that didn't meet grades, so they fed it to the cows. So cows have become a waste dump for society's garbage foods. On top of forage and other things that people feed, but whatever's cheapest, just give it to the cow and hope she makes a lot of milk. So it's really that disconnect from the consumer saying, I want to nourish your family in whole form to build their immune systems and be your best friend that we've done at Organic Pasture. So we built that best friend relationship with our consumers. So it's a different food altogether. And the FDA will not acknowledge any of the documentation or any of the standards we use or the testing we do, anything. They won't acknowledge it because it runs completely contrary to their relationships with the processors under the pasteurized milk ordinance. They're in bed with them, period.
Well, I'm cynical enough to believe that in addition to that reason, there is the whole big pharma side that we need to sell pills to all of you people to fix the problems we created by not letting you eat right food in the first place.
Well, there's more to that, Dan. Actually, there's very much more to that that really, really pours concrete about what you just said. It makes it solid as a rock. And that is, if I make medical claims on this wonderful, precious raw milk here, based on all the European studies and even the PubMed NIH published stuff that's journal reviewed and peer reviewed, they will claim I have created a new drug.
Yes.
And I must have a permit from the FDA to make that claim based on their drug approval, because foods don't prevent disease. Only drugs are used to cure disease. And that is a pharmaceutical whorehouse. I'm sorry. It's what it is. Where they're just fornicating back and forth. And it's horrible, because who pays the price? You and I and the public in America do that don't know better, or the people that wouldn't know better about the fact. Yeah, the people that
literally are paying the price in the form of taxes. So we've got free vaccines, except we just had 9 new billionaires in big pharma. Something about that doesn't make sense.
Well, if we had the innate and the adaptive immune systems working properly in our bodies, the flu, COVID, you name it, would not have the effect it has on our bodies. You remember, most people are dying from COVID and those kinds of stuff have these compromised immune systems and have these other, obesity or asthma or other that generally cause their problems. And now we got these super strains that are hurting people. So it's really a complete disregard to human health as the foundation of prevention versus, just cure it with something after the fact that's pharmaceutical related, which is really a travesty when you think about it. It's horrible.
Well, we do, you mentioned the take the milk apart and put it into a pill. And I'm not sure it's specific to Americans only, but because this is where I live, this is what I'm familiar with.
Right.
We love pills. Just give me something easy. I don't want to work at it. I just want to make it easy. And it always makes the problem worse. Let's talk a minute about why it seemed that government intervention and pasteurization was, again, with air quotes, necessary. Because for a long, long time, you mentioned water buffalo, and I love buffalo mozzarella. It's fantastic stuff. But there's a history of the world living on raw milk, either human or bovine, or I don't know the word for goat, but goat or sheep or whatever. And then
caprine.
Something changed.
Caprine is the goat. For 10,000 years, maybe 15,000 years, it's been well documented by archaeologists that humans have consumed lots of raw milk. And in fact, it's been thought of as the thing that actually made society more competitive, which if you could bring your cow with you, you had whole food today. You didn't have to grow it. You didn't have to hunt it. You didn't have to fish for it. You had food today. That your kids could thrive, because raw milk is a whole food. You can survive literally on it if you had to. So, you think about the history. Let's go into 1870s, 1880s. People were bringing their cow with them into the city, into New York, Boston, Philadelphia. And in the 1870s, 1880s, all around the world, Moscow, New York, Philadelphia, Chicago, Great Britain and England, London, people were bringing their cows with them to town because it was so dependent on them out in the countryside. But in the countryside, there was fresh water and sunshine and grass. In the city, there wasn't. So what are you going to feed a cow when you get to downtown Boston, New York? Well, what were they producing there? They were producing distillery grains. They were doing distillery. They were all kinds of not wines, but other things, whiskey and things like that. So what was a byproduct of that was brewers' distillers' grains. So they started feeding the cows just that, maybe occasional some pasture or not. But it was a muddy mess. No clean water, no flushing toilets, no washing of hands, brewers, distillers, grains, very sick, unhealthy cows in crowded conditions. And it wasn't a farm environment. It was a city environment. From that, there was something called the milk problem. About 40% of people that drank that milk, the children died every year. It was disgusting and horrible. But it was a city phenomenon, not a country phenomenon. The milk that was being produced in the country was actually going to the Mayo Clinic and curing people. So it was interesting how Dr. Henry Coit in 1893 said, enough, enough. we're going to develop the American Association of Medical Milk Commissions to certify dairies to produce clean raw milk. And he did. And it was a thriving operation. In fact, Altadena Dairy in Los Angeles with Stuvies was the last AAMMC producer in 1999. But at the same time, Strauss, he was a philanthropist. He owned the Macy's department stores. Strauss brought in the parboiler, which was an early form of pasteurization from France. By the way, Pasteur never pasteurized milk ever. He pasteurized wines and things like that to get rid of the bacteria to make the yeast grow in fermentation. So he used that technology to come to America and cook the living heck out of this filthy milk. And what do you know? About 30, 40% fewer people died. Still had lots of problems with water quality, but it was a way to exploit filthy milk and commercialize it and make it cheap. And so that was developed in the 1910s, 1920s into a pretty effective pasteurization process and some rules around it about how to cook your milk to make it less toxic because it was so dirty. But, you know, pasteurization and raw milk kind of lived side by side until the 1940s. And after World War II, we didn't have any money and we were all poor. And remember, we fixed social problems with nuclear bombs and we sprayed DDT on things. And you know, smoking was good for lungs in 1940s. That's how screwed up we were in 1940. So we weren't really looking at nutrition. And Adele Davis hadn't come around yet, and Weston A. Price wasn't really preaching too much. And so people were disregarding their health. All kinds of additives we put in, preservatives we put in your food that were not natural and terrible for you. And out of that whole thing, all kinds of food safety regulations and stuff came in to try to regulate food, but they never looked at whole food. Processing became something that was good for distribution and good for shelf life, be damned on the consumer side. Right. So processing, production, distribution became the big thing. And so more shelf stable things were, the better. And pasteurization is an outgrowth of that. But people have become a lot wiser now that we understand the gut microbiome and the human genome and breast milk and those things. We realize whole foods really matter. Whole foods really matter. And that's why you see farmers markets with enlightened people wanting to eat foods that are unprocessed directly from the farm and just minimally cooked to get the whole nutrition and nothing else, because there's been a lot of other things put into our food. So that's kind of the history of why pasteurization is so popular, because it made filthy milk safe, but yet very allergenic and hard to digest. And they're paying the price right now by losing that market share of 1% to 2% per year. People don't want to drink the stuff anymore.
You know, there's, I think part of the appreciation of all this shelf stableness was, look at what we can do as humans. Look what we can do. This is amazing what we're able to do. And I think that on some level, yes, there is an appreciation that, wow, the innovation to use our mind and these 10 digits to do things, there is some benefit to that. And no doubt that on some level, processing food has been a benefit to mankind.
There's no question. There's no question. And if you think about mankind, we spent a lot of our time all through history of mankind starving and not having enough food. So to have the idiosyncrasies of the nichiness of a wonderful pure raw milk in today's age seems kind of nichey. But prior to 120 years ago, it wasn't. It was common. It was everybody had a cow next door. It's where you got your food, right?
It is. And so, you know, people, either you knew somebody who had a cow, you knew somebody who had chickens, or you had them, and you had a, there was kind of a, there was both commerce but barter system. We've gotten away from that all. So now when when it's reintroduced as an idea, it looks weird. It looks bizarre. Oh, these new agey, you know, whatever, witches. But yeah, there's a lack of appreciation for where we came from food-wise, but at some level, it's all tied together.
You ask 99.9% of children where food comes from, and they say, it comes from a store. What do you mean?
Yeah.
They don't know where
food comes from.
They don't have a clue. How can they know? That's where mommy takes them to get their food. They go to the store. So, yeah, we've evolved a long ways from the farm, and from that, we've evolved a long ways from the ecosystems that support our microbiome. The fact that we need to be in connection with nature to be healthy. And when we dissociate ourselves from nature, we become autoimmune messes. This is very clear in the whole human genome study that was done many years ago about the fact that the more disconnected we are from natural environments, the more disease-ridden we become. It's really interesting how that works. And then, you know, we always get sick. We take antibiotics, and the antibiotics have really destroyed the immune system, creating all kinds of superbugs that can't be killed by antibiotics. So we kind of worked ourselves into a corner here, so where we've neglected
bigger antibiotics.
Yeah. We've neglected. But, you know, there's a little stress test there. There's a little shock therapy there, too. All my friends in medicine, this is probably the most disruptive thing that's happened in medicine in the last 100 years. And that is that when people are in ICUs and they've received every round of antibiotic known to man, and they're dying because of C. diff, Clostridium difficile, what's the thing that cures them 95% of the time? A fecal transplant flushing their lower gut. But that is about as ultra probiotic as you can get, right? You know, it's the food and the bacteria together that flushes the lower gut that saves their life literally 9 to 10 times out of 20, you know, 90% of the time they live. And they're getting the last rites, they're going to die, and some really high-quality crap from a nurse donates it, and what do you know? They live. That's not an antibiotic. And the FDA freaks out about this. In fact, they've wanted to have a standardization for fecal transplant, and the doctors say, I'm sorry, you're going to standardize somebody's poop? It doesn't happen. So that's kind of really disruptive, bringing us back to ground level, saying, what the hell are we doing? We really do have to reinvent ourselves.
So let's talk more about, because we're getting there, let's talk about food as medicine. And you brought up, I actually want to find somebody to talk about this, because I've only learned that the gut biome exists and the gut brain axis is a thing, and it's a lot to consider,
a lot to digest.
I was going to avoid that obvious pun, but yes, there's, because it's still so new, it's kind of like the ocean, the most undiscovered thing, yet it's the most basic thing we have. There's a lot there. And I'm pretty sure I know that it just has been disregarded as, I have this feeling in my gut. Well, that's just nerves. It's just butterflies. Sure. Yeah. We don't really give it the credit it's due, but let's talk about.
Yeah.
Not just raw milk, but food as medicine, and how this kind of gets outside of raw milk, but how whole foods are, even if you're keto. I mean, sure. I know that the keto folks are going to avoid certain fruits because they're higher in sugar than other things, but as a human, you're better off eating the apple than you are eating the applesauce, and you're certainly better off than drinking the apple juice, because there's the whole thing there. So let's start with
the liberty of quoting Dr. Annette Jewett, and Anahi Jewett, who is a foremost NIH cancer researcher at UCLA. Dr. Annette Jewett has been a friend of me for 15 years. I did presentations down at UCLA to PhDs about raw milk and everything, but she says three things are really, really critical. Number one, a biodiversity of bacteria in your gut is really the thing that drives inflammation to be reduced in your body. But you can't have a biodiversity of lots of different kinds of bacteria unless you give them whole food to eat. So three things have to happen. You have to have a whole food diet, because bacteria love whole food. They can't stand preserved food because the preservatives kill off bacteria. That's how you get shelf life. Number two, you need a biodiversity of bacteria. In other words, you can't just take a single strain. You need all kinds of cousins, uncles, nephews of bacteria, all kinds of different stuff in order to live and create a competitive environment, which actually helps the body do all kinds of things, functional things like creating vitamins too. But I mean, protective, they create enzymes. This biodiversity of bacteria is really, really critical to decrease allergies and inflammation in the body. Inflammation drives disease processes. So if you want to decrease disease, you get rid of your inflammation, you do that by a biodiversity of bacteria and the whole food that feeds them. So that's pioneering thought when it comes to, wait a minute, what are we doing in medicine today? Well, we disregard diets for the most part, and we give antibiotics. Well, diets, that's a disregard for whole food as nutrition, and we just don't even think about it. You don't even think about it. People are drinking Coca-Colas and potato chips and all this crap from McDonald's. And the bottom line is you're not feeding your microbiome properly. And then the diversity, where'd that go? The antibiotics to reduce that to next to nothing. So the diversity means contact with the outside world to gather those kinds of bacteria and put them in your gut. So you have biodiversity. So we've really, really got pioneers saying these things, but it's kind of into a void with that they're not being listened to, because it's such in contradiction to practice and culture today. We've been going along for 100 years, eat anything you want, take your drug, take your antibiotics to save your life. And that's complete contradiction to the true science that says, wait a minute, you're going to usher in autoimmune diseases, cancers, all kinds of crazy stuff by disregarding whole food nutrition and biodiversity in your gut, because inflammation is going through the roof. So we got a real problem on ourselves. We've got 130,000 colostomies being performed per year from Crohn's disease, and that's considered good because we can treat it? That's horrible. And so we've got ourselves a real problem. And to wake people like you're doing on your show to whole food nutrition, less processed, unprocessed, cultured foods, biodiversity of bacteria, raw milk, all these kinds of things are given to us by nature that sustain us for tens of thousands of years very successfully. And venturing off into highly processed stuff is danger zone. If you look at the USDA dietary guidelines right now, they talk about nutrient-dense, unprocessed foods. I'm sorry, that's code for raw milk, guys. In fact, the first thing they put on their website, if you look at the USDA guidelines for 2021 through 2025, the first thing they've got is a logo. Even above the USDA logo is a mom breastfeeding her baby. Baby on the boob. They're screaming raw milk, guys, but they're not able to say it because it's politically in contradiction with processors' interests and what they've preached about for so many years to just kill it all to make it safe. No, you need to grow good diversity in your gut to make yourself protected so you won't get sick. So we're very much in contradiction, but the science is 100% behind us. The politics is not, because it changes the place that people make money. And the battleship of pasteurization doesn't want to move and change. It doesn't want to change to, hey, CAFO operation, you need to put that cow in a pasture and start worrying about whether there's bad bacteria, get the manure out of the milk. They don't want to do that. They want to buy that milk super cheap so they can process it, put throughput through their plant, and make money on a brand that they've been promoting forever and ever. So we have a real challenge here, but we also have a real opportunity for those that want to reconnect with consumers and teach them about whole food nutrition and how life can be a whole lot better than where it is today.
Well, so one thing about the USDA is you would think that there's just a room full of people who make these decisions, and I think it's only about four or five of them. And there's politics in that room. Two or three of them are vegans.
So really?
They have an agenda to not focus on meat-based things on their MyPlate picture. So there's, I've done an episode on that. I have to check for the number on that, but it gets... It's just everywhere we go. I think the other thing I mentioned, the appreciation of innovation, look what we can do. We can take this perishable thing and make it last longer.
Right.
That's a good thing.
Yep.
We have, there was the Snackwells craze from so long ago of take the fat out and triple the sugar and look, it's healthy. But there's part of the unintended consequence of all of this innovation is we have this I don't know if you ever watched The Simpsons. It was in 20 years, the best clip is Homer's waiting for the microwave to ding because there's burritos in there. Dope, 7 seconds. That's Americans. I want it 5 seconds ago. So we have to wait now. That's already too long. So anything that doesn't come in a packet, in a wrapper, on a shelf stable, we've been conditioned to not want, not like, not prefer.
Correct.
So we have now we have a problem because we don't eat real foods. We eat in our cars. We don't sit down. We don't have to walk anywhere. We walk to the car and have breakfast, lunch, and dinner on wheels and never have to move. And there's a lot of other problems there, and that's more than we can deal with on this show, but there are issues. There's big issues.
Big issues, yep.
And so getting back to a sense of, some of the keto folks are talking about ancestral lifestyles. What did grandma do in 1900, and grandpa? How did they eat? How did they live? In the 1900s, they worked hard.
Yep.
They ate whatever they wanted, but they also ate food that had their hands on it. Yes, they touched it. They knew it. They knew they loved Bessie, but boy, she does taste good.
Yep.
Don't do that now.
They consume things like raw kefir, because remember, they didn't have refrigeration back then.
What is kefir? Tell me about kefir.
Kefir is raw milk fermented with 12 or 15 or 20 different kinds of bacteria added into it, and even some yeast added into it. It has tremendous biodiversity. Yogurt's got just a couple of different kinds of bacteria. Kefir has these 12 plus the 120 or so of additional bacteria that are found in raw milk alone. So you got a massive diversity of bacteria and the food to feed it. And if you think about the history of raw milk, they really believe that not a lot of people drank raw milk directly except for the farmer. His neighbors probably drank kefir because of the fermented form actually sustained the shelf life for 60 days, 90 days, because it's sour.
So that's
soured raw milk.
Something that happens. So if you're a dairy farmer and you have all this milk and you just have it at
body temperature
on the counter, somewhere in a clean,
yep,
possibly sterile container,
yep,
because everything's in there, is this kind of, so I know about taking the dead product and adding either sour cream or yogurt to it,
yep,
and making creme fraiche,
yep,
making my own sour cream. I have a little incubator here. I've done that.
Yep.
Is kefir kind of like this raw milk product has been cultured because the things that are already in there to do that?
Yes, but you can add back one more thing. Kefir originated by putting raw milk into the stomach of a calf. You butcher the calf, you take the stomach, and you pour the milk into the stomach, and the enzymes in the stomach actually would ferment it. Things were not clean. They're not clean now in second and third world countries. You put the milk into a gourd that was used for milk last week. You have the mother cultures that are growing in there already. So you have that external inoculum on top of the biodiversity of the raw milk that it has already. So you have a tremendously biodiverse food based on the semi-clean or maybe even dirty container that you had. They had the cultures, much like the mother cultures for making a sourdough bread. Same kind of thing there. You think of that.
Right.
But
I can't remember. There's the enzyme in the stomach they use for cheese. I can't remember what it is.
Well, there's rennet.
That's the one.
But the interesting thing about this is you would make from kefir, you'd make a farmer's cheese. You'd put it through a cheesecloth and you drain the whey off. You use that whey to ferment your vegetables. And the cheese would, the casein would be cultured, would be the cultured clotted part. That would be used, and you'd put a little salt on it and some herbs and have a phenomenal farmer's cheese. So all these products have a fermented cousin relationship, because fermentation is one of the lost arts that came from our great grandparents and before, because that was a way to extend shelf life, preserve foods without killing them.
Sauerkraut and kimchi. On and on and on.
Kombucha. All these kinds of things are living foods that our body craves and it drives the immune system. Yet today we use preservatives, sodium, some kind of crazy of nitrates or something, you know, and these other funky things you can't pronounce that are on the labels that go on and on and on and on. They're all those things that enhance flavor, enhance body, enhance mouthfeel, and extend shelf life based on the fact it kills molds and bacteria. So what do you think those things do when they get to your gut? Kill mold, kill bacteria.
Their job.
That's really going to be horrible for your human microbiome. So we're evolving from that, saying we want living whole foods, thank you. And you could cook them, that's fine. But you always want to have your living whole foods as part of it. The kimchi and the sauerkrauts and the raw milks and the kefirs, because that's what's the inoculum for the compost pile in your gut. Makes it all break down and work. So,
but even cooking it at home, for whatever you're making, make it a cream sauce, who knows what you're doing, making soup. The home cook isn't adding this long laundry list of things you can't grow, pick, or pronounce.
Well, there was a study done in Europe, and I'm sure it's been done by many people, but it's just something I remembered from 2 years ago at the International Milk Genomics Consortium. They're talking about steaming vegetables increases the bioavailability uptake of the available nutrients and the available vitamins like 40%. A raw carrot is harder to digest in your gut than one that's steamed, which makes it liberated in terms of being able to break down and digest it. So there's a role for cooking, but not all foods need to be cooked. You need to have a combination of uncooked and cooked together to actually have a wonderfully, you know, digestible, you know, gut compatible food.
Right. So when you make your salad, don't use a commercial dressing, make your own dressing.
That's it. And you know, one more thing that's really important. The child's gut has evolved now where instead of having the wonderful tissues of the intestinal lining and then a mucosal lining inside, the mucosa is missing in most children because the antibiotics have been used so frequently. It destroys that mucus lining, which protects you against pathogens. So what children may have been protected against from foodborne pathogens 120 years ago because they had a strong mucosal lining if they were eating whole food nutrition before the advent of antibiotics and preservatives, they don't have that now. So you see E. coli taking kids out. And these E. coli are antibiotic resistant. So we've created ourselves just a whole madness in terms of where we're at by not thinking about the long-term consequences of what we're doing. And I'm not anti-antibiotic at all. I think it's a great tool, but it's one to really be careful with, because if you abuse it, you'll actually cause a toxic environment which will kill you. So you really right. got to be careful with these tools that we have that are miracles of modern man. And you got to be doing 90% preventative and 10% curative after you get sick, maybe. But, you know, you have a lot less disease. And we all know the disease in this country drives a whole machine, healthcare machine, which makes a lot of money. That's the biggest, it's really the biggest pack we have politically is pharmaceuticals. And protecting right. their interests are beyond reproach in terms of America as part of politics. You just don't go there because they'll smash you.
Well, even if you, I follow a couple of my local senators, and Big Pharma is so off limits that they will go out of the way to help them even more.
Correct. They're scared to death of them because the contributions to their political campaigns are monumental. They're huge. Big Pharma is untouchable at this point in America, unfortunately.
Well, everything breaks. The problem, the question is how, and this is one of those things no one can answer, but how much bigger must it get before it finally crumbles? And
well, I think
in the course of that,
Dan, I think last year was a great stress test. All through March and April, they said, if you have these signs and symptoms, don't go to the doctor. My God, all you heard was go to the doctor, go to the doctor, go to the doctor before because they wanted your money. Well, it was like, no, please don't come to the doctor. I think that was the breaking point where they did not have a solution and they didn't want your problems coming into their doctor's office because they didn't want to get sick and they didn't know how to deal with it because it was beyond their means. And that's really looking at the dysfunction of the fact that America was fat, obese, you know, had asthma, all kinds of problems with autoimmune diseases, heart disease, all these things that generally most people that are in that subcat would actually get sick and die or get sick at least. So the abandonment of the fundamentals of health, you know, vitamin D levels, vitamin C levels, and keeping yourself in good condition and exercise and whole food nutrition are not part of the dialogue. They mention them once in a while, but now it's all about vaccine, 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 vaccine. And, you know, they may work just fine, but they are not the long-term cure for anything. It's fixing America's health that's the problem. And I don't care how many vaccinations you get, it's not going to make you healthier. It's not going to do anything for health. Your food that you eat is what the foundation of your health is, right? So it's really quite sad.
So this is the portion of the show for the listener to become the activist.
Yes.
I used to know this better. I know that I think 27 states, it's flat out illegal. In the states where it is legal, there's two parts to this. In the states where raw milk is legal, what can the listeners and consumers do to improve the circumstances for the growers to have a bigger access to sell raw milk? And in the states where it's illegal, what avenues exist for consumers to petition their government to say, hey, this is a choice I wish to make. This is a voluntary choice on my part. Yeah. You don't get to decide that for me. How do they get that done?
Well, I'm part of the Raw Milk Institute, which was established about 11 years ago to provide standards where standards didn't exist to voluntarily bring your milk to a very high level of excellence. And we work all over the world. It's interesting that fewer and fewer states have actually made raw milk completely illegal. They've actually created little niche carve-outs for how you can get raw milk, like you can buy a part of a cow or a cow share, where you become the actual owner of the cow, so they have the right to get your own milk, and you hire the farmer to milk her for you, but you go get the milk. So most states have some kind of cow share carve-out, but even in Hawaii, where raw milk's completely illegal and they don't have cow shares, I was able to get raw milk very easily from a 3-cow operation there on one of the islands. So there's almost always a place to get it if you want to get it. There's a great website called realmilk.com where you can see the laws across the United States in each state where raw milk is. And, you know, if you want raw milk, it's not hard to find or get. But the best thing you can do is reconnect to your farmer, support your farmer, and eat whole food nutrition. That is the key to having a strong immune system. And you got to move your butt. You've got to get out and get active. You've got to get in the sunshine. Got to get a little bit of clothes off your back. Get some sunshine on you. Get closer to the dirt. Walk around barefoot once in a while. Get closer to nature. Breathe some deep, good air. And get to know your farmer. You're kind of rejoining your great-great-grandparents a little bit in terms of how they lived. You can still have the modern conveniences of cell phones and do all those kinds of things. And if you get hurt in a car accident, you still have modern trauma centers that come pick up in a helicopter. Wonderful, great. But the bottom line is, let's embrace our ancestral wisdoms, which has incredible value. Because if you look at what the trajectory of where we are right now with antibiotic-resistant bacteria, with antibiotics not working very well anymore, with pharmaceutical solutions and all those kinds of things, it's a bad news kind of thing. It's doomsday scenario in terms of where we're going. If we redirect ourselves and embrace our ancestral wisdoms, we're actually in a really good place. So That's what I would encourage people to do. Reconnect to your farmer, eat whole food nutrition.
That's a good advice. All right, folks, let's take a moment out for a word from Jake about his Tasting Anarchy podcast.
Hey everyone, Jake here, host of the Tasting Anarchy podcast. Join my co-host Mason and I each week as we explore the world of wine and alcohol through a Liberty lens. You can find us on all your major podcatchers, tastinganarchy.com or Tasting Anarchy on Twitter. Tasting Anarchy, your wine and liberty podcast. Find out how much government is in your drink.
All right, I want to move on to a different part of the show, which is kind of a short answer. Six or seven questions. That's kind of just a fun thing to do.
Sure.
Of the five flavors, sweet, salty, sour, bitter, or umami, which one do you enjoy the most?
Sour.
What's your favorite food?
I love sushi.
What's your least favorite food?
Anything that's got a long ingredient list makes me feel very regretful.
Well, it gets you excited.
It's like, God, that's an addictive food I cannot put in my body. Throw it away.
Yeah. It's a good answer. What gets you excited?
What gets me excited is to see children that come from enlightened parents come to visit our farms, and they say they want to see the cow where the milk comes from. And these kids have the most perfect teeth, strong immune systems, and don't have ear infections, and are happy and healthy and playing in the dirt. And that makes me really happy. I'm a granddad with six grandkids, but to see other kids with enlightened parents makes me really, really happy.
What turns you off?
Money-driven greed within the policymakers and government makes me sick to my stomach.
It's a lot of them.
Got plenty of that.
What sound do you love?
Oh, my gosh. The sound I love. Laughing children.
What sound do you hate?
Hate. What sound do I hate? I don't know that I hate any particular sound. The sounds I don't like to hear, sound of a car wreck. I worked as a paramedic too many years.
Oh, yeah. No, that's reasonable. What's your favorite food indulgence?
Indulgence? Raw ice cream or raw whipped cream and strawberries. Oh, my God.
Man. You know, years ago, my dad started a tradition with us kids since he wasn't much of a drinker. And New Year's midnight was just too late for kids. So he started a tradition of 6 half-gallons of different ice creams and dealer's choice of toppings. So everything.
That's great.
So we would have a New Year's Eve ice cream sundae. So it was just decadent. It was
wonderful.
Just obscene. It was fun. So now it's been pared down, but I make my own ice cream.
There you go.
But of course I use the dead pasteurized stuff, but I make a really rich creme anglaise with half and half. So it's just nice and fat. But man,
try some with raw milk, a little bit of raw cream, and a couple of eggs and some sugar in there. Oh my, or some honey. You died and gone to heaven.
I got to get a look around and see what's available near me. I know that there's some farmers by me. I'm going to look for kefir because I don't know if I said it right, but I'm very interested in this idea.
You're in Los Angeles, right?
I'm in Southern Oregon.
Oh, Southern Oregon. Yeah. There are some cow shear operations. There's Billy over in Prineville. She distributes all over Western Oregon. But Oregon's got a strange deal going on because they forbid the sale of raw milk in stores. So you have to connect to farmers. And believe me, there's quite a few farmers I work with up there that really go hog wild on milk. They do a great job. Go ahead.
Well, I'm gonna go find them. I'm going to figure out who they are.
Yep.
All right. So this may not be the case, but I want to find out, is there a book you can think of that for people who want to know more about raw milk and even gut biome or gut brain access? Is there something that people can read that you think is worth mentioning?
The Story of Raw Milk is a good one by Dr. Ron Schmidt.
Okay.
David Gumpert had a book on raw milk now. I can't remember the name of it. It was a story about raw milk. I would really look at building healthy babies, looking at the gut biome, the human genome, and breastfeeding, and how you start life properly, C-section versus vaginal birth, breastfeeding, all those things, how to eat well when you're pregnant so you actually have a strong baby. Those are really important. And there's a lot of that out there right now. But I'd look at Dr. Bonnie Basler's work. She was the MIT researcher that worked on the Human Genome Project. Fascinating work, a lot of TED Talks. There's just a lot of people that are in that area now talking about how to build that gut brain connection. And now they have found the gut lung connection as well. The gut is the seat of human health. If you look at Hippocrates, he said, all disease begins in the gut. Hippocrates said, let food be your medicine and medicine be your food. He said, do no harm. Three big quotes from a man that lived 2,400 years ago that was an apostle in terms of knowing what the heck was going on a long time ago in Greece.
Very good. Well, I've watched some of Bonnie's videos based on a recommendation in one of your videos. So
sure.
It gets around. Yeah. How can people follow you and where can they find your work?
Raw Milk Institute is probably where I do most of my stuff because it's a nonprofit that does not speak about particular brands. So I'm able to go outside the reservation a little bit and talk about the medical benefits of raw milk and those kinds of things. So we're not talking about buy my milk. We're talking about this is an idea by researchers and this is the science. And I love peer-reviewed science that's not jeopardized by corruption that comes from people that are well-intended, funded properly, coming from a place of a good heart, that they know what's going on and they're really looking for answers. So I would look at rawmilkinstitute.org. I would also look at our Instagram over at Raw Farm. My daughter does a lot of stuff there, which is pretty cool. I don't do as much online as I should. I did about 500 in-person presentations between 2005 and 2015. Did like 40 a year. It was just crazy to build our market where get to know your farmer, get to know your food. I did that. I did it. I'm a private pilot. I have my own plane for years and years. I'd fly anywhere. I'd take free raw milk to people with a videotape, with my PowerPoint, and I'd sit down for 3 hours and just answer questions and hug babies and kiss moms and give them free raw milk and talk. I did that forever. So that kind of built our brand in terms of what we are in California. But raw milk has always been legal in California, so we didn't have to battle back per se. And I have to give the credit to the Stubbies brothers in Altadena who stood guard at the gate to keep the raw milk laws being changed. They really did a good job for 50 years to make sure we didn't become like every other state where processors got rid of the raw milk.
You know, we think about California and so often we think about the things that they're getting wrong. It's hard to remember that sometimes they get something right.
There's a few things they got right. There's some things they're really having a hard time with right now, I'll tell you.
Yeah, and those are the things everyone thinks about. Say, California, oh, no, I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for your time today. I appreciate that. I know we're going to give you enough time to go get ready for your next thing. I appreciate it.
Dan, I really appreciate your shirt you have on today, which has got Dad with a Superman thing around it. You've got some awesome kids that love you, and that's wonderful. That's a tribute to you, buddy.
Well, they do. Sometimes it they're kids, so sometimes it's a challenge, but they're good. I like them a lot.
And I'm wearing my shirt today. It says good medicine, and I really believe the best medicine is whole food. So anyway, thanks for having me, Dan. I appreciate it. Anytime.
Thank you very much. All right, folks, that's going to do it. I'll put the links to Mark's company, Raw Milk Institute, on the show notes page, culinarylibertarian.com/153. One point I want to make is the title of the Story of Milk book was misspoken, but I put Mark on the spot. Dr. Schmidt's book is called The Untold Story of Milk, and there will be a link for that on the show notes page. I'll also add a link to the Raw Milk Institute's Instagram page. If you like the show, please support me through my Patreon or PayPal tabs on culinarylibertarian.com/support. Please share this episode on your social media feeds and like it when you see it. And rate and review the show on your favorite podcatcher to help more folks find this podcast. Have a good week, and I'll see you soon. Music for the Culinary Libertarian Podcast is provided by Matthew Bankert at mattbankert.com.